If you're listening to this podcast, my assumption is that this word transition is somehow either circling you in your life right now, or it has hit you square between the eyes. And now you find yourself in this place of discomfort, in this wilderness, this disorientation, this season where you're asking yourself, what just happened? And where did I just come from? And where am I going? And that season is not a comfortable season whatsoever. The conversation that you're about to listen to is with Dane Sanders, and he founded something called Men and Women of Discomfort. Now, before you turn the podcast off and say, I'll skip to the next one or one of the ones in the past, this is one that you have to listen to. What if the discomfort, the season that you find yourself in right now, is the very season where the greatest fruit of your life could be, that on the other side of this discomfort season that you find yourself in, there could actually be joy, there could actually be purpose once again, there could actually be ministry, there could be freedom on the other side of the pain that you're currently experiencing. This conversation, I warned Dane, I said, this might be a 3-hour conversation, and I had lots of discipline and we held it to an hour. And so I want you to listen. And yes, we're talking about an organization that he has started, and you'll get to hear all about it, called Men and Women of Discomfort. But I want you to listen to it through your lens. I want you to listen to it through what you're going through right now and where God is leading you, because I promise you that God is with you in the very midst of the season that you're going through right now. This is Dane Sanders, and this is the Life After Ministry podcast. Dane Sanders, welcome to the Life After Ministry podcast. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Matt. It's good to be here.
I've been looking forward to this for a long, long time. So thank you for jumping on. You have been in full-time vocational ministry. I would argue that you're still in full-time vocational ministry, but take me back to the beginning. Take me back to the days of Rock Harbor. And maybe even there's stuff before that.
So coming to faith, I grew up in Nova Scotia, Canada. And I found myself as a in college as a fledgling athlete who was 6 feet tall playing a sport where everyone was 6'9", and the sport was about to come to an end for me. And I had just finished my freshman year, and I had won like rookie of the year for that team, and it was a really accomplished team. It was really cool, but it was really the pinnacle of my athletic career. And on a crazy set of larks, I found myself on an airplane to Australia. And on that ride, I met some people on the plane who became my roommates because I went over by myself. I didn't know who I was going to live with. I was 19 years old. And while I was over there, I had wanderings. Talk about wanderings, like just straight out of casting cliches of like leather backpacks and back in those days, like a Walkman and a journal that was really cool. And I just thought I was kind of living my dream. But I was pretty low, actually. I was pretty, talk about wandering. I didn't know what the heck was I doing on that side of the world, wandering around. And I wandered into, I was depressed and 17 time zones away from home, and looked up church in the phone book, because I thought that's where you go. I'd grown up in a Baptist church, but I would not call myself a practicing Christian in that season of my life by any stretch. And had a radical conversion experience at this missionary church. The pastor had to drive like 90 minutes to pick me up to go to church. And I think I was their first convert at that church, because they gave me a Bible when I became a Christian. And then the following Sunday, they asked me for $20 to pay for the Bible, because I don't think they had enough money to give away free Bibles. Anyways, that was an incredible launch. I became the zealot Christian. And I think that's when things started for me. I felt this, like I was that guy who knew nothing, who was a bullhorn and everywhere I went. And I remember debating with Muslims at coffee shops 2 weeks into being a Christian, and finding the Proverbs and underlining the words that were important. And every verses important in Proverbs. And then I went to a youth hostel, and there was this guy there who clearly was a Christian, or he wasn't clearly a Christian to me, but he came up to me and said, "Hey, you can tell you're a Christian." And I was like, "Yeah." He's like, "Hey, can you chill out just a little? Like, you're not, there's more to this story than you think there is.
You're making us look bad."
Yeah, kinda. And he's like, "I just graduated from this place called Biola. You might want to think about going to a Christian college. It could really serve you." And sure enough, that was the beginning of this incredible adventure of eventually coming back to Canada for a year, and then coming down to California and going to Biola, getting my undergrad, continuing on to Talbot, and getting graduate work in philosophy of ethics, philosophy of religion and ethics, and really had this kind of bias, non-academic bias, but this practical bias of like, I just want to take these ideas and put them to work and, you know, be a champion for the kingdom, and exposure to some incredible flourishing people in life, like the Dallas Willards of the world, and the Larry Crabs, and the James Houstons, and the Eugene Petersons, like just crazy exposures that I, even the Paul Youngs, like just weird people that kept crossing my path and having significant influence, disproportionate influence, not to mention the bigger influence, which was the people around me, many of which you and I, you know, we both call friends. And that, I believe, marked me. And I just went on a series of assignments, you know, to use Brad Lomnick's language. I wouldn't have called them that, but that's what they were. And I just thought it was like a really unfortunate resume. Like I just had this hodgepodge of experiences going from thing to thing, but being convicted that this was the right next thing for me over and over again. I was a resident director at Biola University. Then I became a teacher up at Westmont College, teaching leadership and character development. And then I got wooed to leave this cherry job at Westmont to go work at a mega church in Orange County called Rock Harbor, and got fired from there 3 years in from my friend who wooed me down, and a month before Christmas. And there was no scandal, and I didn't know what to do, and I felt called to that church, so I didn't leave the church. And in the process of staying, that actually was an interruption to what was expected of Christians who get let go of churches. They're supposed to leave the church. But since there was no scandal, I had no reason to do that. And I kind of liked it. I was kind of poking the guy who fired me, and who's now one of my best friends. And we became friends through that process. I had nothing to do there, so I wandered in and started working for this outfit called, or not working, just volunteering for this outfit called Alpha. And then eventually came to work for them. Then I went to work for Biola. Actually, I got that mixed up. I worked for Biola, and then raising money for them, and then I raised money for Alpha, and then got asked to quit my job at Alpha, and then left Alpha, and was just like an independent coach guy running around doing a bunch of things, consultant, worked for Don Miller and StoryBrand, and then finally, in all this consulting work, it's kind of culminated into two major projects that I'm into right now that I've been in for the last 5 years or so. Which is, I work for an organization called Common Thread Collective, where I oversee employee development and performance and help people improve. But the reason I even have that job is because I started this little project called Men and Women of Discomfort, which I have a hunch will be the majority of our conversation today, which if I could call anything a calling, it's this probably, but I might discover later it is an assignment, but my experience of it is, it's the most true thing that I've been a part of that has pervasive benefit in everything that I'm doing, including my job at Common Thread. So if people are still tracking, yeah. That's a little bit of the kind of the roadmap to get to here.
We'll put the timeline into the show notes and be able to just kind of mark it by year and all the transitions.
And then
I'll put a link to your LinkedIn. It'll be fine. Yeah. Much easier that
or you could just like cut it all out. Yeah, I'm open to that too.
I'm curious.
Even for our conversation, though, it doesn't matter to me if it lands in the podcast, but yeah. I do think it's helpful context, because through all these plot points, whether or not people know those plot points, what it has been really consistent, the through line through it, is a real significant discontent in all places. Almost every stopping point, I had a significant sense of like, this isn't what I thought it was supposed to be. Huh. I want it to be something that it isn't. And often trying to kind of like jab at it to get it to become my preference. and there was very little kind of submitting to a thing, or and it led to things like my contribution to getting let go at various places. And even though I think I could point to it wasn't entirely on me, I can see now with some time how deeply I contributed to those moments, and how there was a kind of an understanding of what I believe the kingdom to be and my participation in it to be that has very little to do with job security and very little to do with a sense of like, it's the organization's job to adapt to my calling. That's just, I don't know that that's true.
So what have you learned about the Christian community in terms of these transitions that are hard? When you're mentioning something like, and it was the month before Christmas and it was my best friend and, but we're okay now. Yeah. Like there's this tension and there's this rupture, but it seems like there's some repair. But how do we do, you have a little bit of a list of these Christian organizations you've come out of. What are we good at and what do we need help with?
What do these organizations, what are they good at?
Yeah, or just the Christian community in general, do we do transition well?
No, no, okay. No, easy. I mean, no, not even close. I think there's all the way, like, if you think of the lifespan of anyone who works in an organization, a faith-based organization, and I wonder if this is true in other, like other traditions too, I suspect it might be, but when you're appealing to a transcendent force around things like calling and whatever, and then you throw in a largely created structure and hierarchy that really most of the time resembles corporate playbooks more than they do kind of Acts, Book of Acts kind of definitions of what faith-based yes. organizations are supposed to be.
Right.
Why are we surprised, right? It's just like, it's a leveraging of power. This, if I'm in a position, a hierarchical position of power, and I can appeal to God around choices of who's in and who's out and where you fit on the status ladder and who gets paid what to do what and how. And then I throw in my personality and my biases and my sin. Yeah, good luck. Because we start recruiting of like, I think he's the guy, or I think they're the like, as if it's like this, like we're David or something, and Samuel's giving us the nod or something. Like it's outrageous.
Oil. Yes.
Yeah, right. Like it feels like this, and then we have these ceremonies and these rituals to validate these things until you get fired. And then they throw you a cake and maybe in the thing in the you know, team room or whatever, and we just kind of forget all those words that we used. And words that I'm not sure we should have used in the first place. I don't know that a lot of Christian organizations are honest, and I wish we would be a little more thoughtful in what are the things that we can affirm with or not without a position of employment about the people in that organization. And for those who are in those positions of employment, be a little bit more real about like, hey, we're just creating a structure to make this work as best it makes sense. And this is going to evolve over time. And we're really hopeful that while you're with us, it's going to be a really positive thing, but we aren't setting this expectation of where it's so loaded and you're somehow going to be dialed in for life. Cause I think subjectively I was sincere in my pursuit of calling in the context of these organizations. And I think they were sincere. Like they aren't bad people. It's just when we co-mingle all these things together in an unthoughtful way, especially if we're younger and we haven't had a lot of reps, it becomes very, very loaded and kind of ripe for misuse of power, and also ripe for just hurt and struggle. The last year or two, when those folks did the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, I think that was really a telling expose that a lot of folks who've had experiences, whether it be in a megachurch or other places, you know, the reason that it's such a remarkable appeal to so many is because I think it was like this vicarious proxy that so many could relate to and go, oh, I'm that character in that drama. And it keeps playing out over and over and over again.
You haven't listened to the podcast, I'm guessing, but you're talking about a lot of the stuff that we already talk about it with this piece of the on-ramp, bringing people into ministry feels a lot more like a coronation in a kingdom. and we roll out mm-hmm. all the stops. It's very transparent. It's very elder run. It's very prayerful. And we kind of pull out the sword and we say, I dub thee pastor. And it's this beautiful, you know, the trumpets are flaring and all the little girls in the kingdom are twirling their dresses and butterflies are around. But on the way out, it's don't let the drawbridge hit you on the way out. It feels HR, totally. It feels loaded, and it feels legal. And that's the hurt mm. because you're so invested in a community and you're trying to figure out what just happened. These were my friends, and you're trying to make sense of all of that. You're in a position yeah. now where you're looking at, did you say employee performance? So how
yes.
how do you do this differently, right? Like, because you have to, at some point, if they're not performing at a certain level, yeah. you have to say goodbye. What's a good way to do that? And is this in a corporate setting or is this in a religious, more nonprofit setting?
It's in a corporate setting, okay. Which I have high preference towards. There's massive trade-offs, by the way. You know, there's things that we don't talk about in the context that I work in my day job that can sometimes feel like less meaningful. And gosh, why don't we pull the lever that we used to pull when I worked at that nonprofit or church or whatever? But we're intentional not to. And I prefer it for a lot of reasons. To answer your question, then I want to make a comment after that. That every day I just came off of an interview. So I'm kind of, me and the COO are the final interviews for people who get or don't get a job. And in this like 50 or 60 person ad agency, basically. And it's a very high bar to work at this organization. And there's not really any entry level positions. You have to be very accomplished to even get an interview. And I find that on the front end of the conversation, we frame it as it actually is, which is it's a competition. And we tell people up front, hey, there's a lot of good people that could do a good job in this role. We're going to do our best to discern who has the skill set, who knows how to please a client, who knows how to navigate colleagues, and who knows how to create value over and over again, and then do it again tomorrow, and then do it again tomorrow, because that's what you're getting measured on. And we're actually going to be explicit and say, these are the things we're going to measure on. And let's tell you about the culture, the environment that you're in, because it's not for everybody. Like, we demand rigor and it's hard all the time. And we get why good people would not want to work here. That is such an easier conversation to have than that coronation environment you're describing, where in a sense, I've never thought of it quite this way before this moment, but it's not competition for a role. The competition is between churches and like, no, we're the true manifestation of the church. And we are the, like, and no one says that out loud, but it sure feels like it when you're in and around those environments on the inside and staff become the epicenter of the church and so on. And I get it. It's like a meaning-making machine. I get why people do it. We just don't make up that kind of meaning in the corporate context that we're in. And people leave all the time, and people get let go all the time, and we do our best to hire the best all the time. And there'll be a day where it might not make sense to me, but I have a hunch if I leave this role, it won't feel the same as when I left those more kind of meaning-laden environments that were so so challenging.
So what is it like, and what do? We say that your last day in a ministry position is day zero. What did you do on day one to figure out that next step? And what am I going to do now? Like, how did you start to answer that? Did you seek career counseling and coaching? Did you need actual therapy to, like, what just became of my heart in this whole process? What was it like for your family? How did you rebuild?
This is where I don't know if my playbook is something that others pattern themselves with or not, but I've always been someone who has several projects running simultaneously. And that's something that I have found to be highly engaging for me. Like, I like that just in my own kind of creative. And I often find that I cross-pollinate a lot. So my interest in one project will actually help me in another project. So I used to be a photographer while I was a pastor. Then on the side, I wrote a book while I was a pastor. And then I started on my vacation time traveling and speaking as a photographer, based on the book, when I was a pastor. And then one of the reasons why I got let go of being a pastor is because my boss said, you're double-minded. You're not wholeheartedly committed to this stuff in the context of what we're doing here. My pushback to him was like, well, if I was making albums like a worship leader was, or writing books that were hyper-Christian, you would be okay with it, because there were people on our staff that were doing those things. And he was like, yeah, I would be okay with it, because that's more single-minded. And it wasn't, there was this view of like, somehow I was kind of not. Anyways, long story short, when I was let go, I actually had things to fall into that didn't generate the same kind of revenue. But I think I just intuitively learned early on that it probably would be wise to expand my skill set if I'm going to have a career that, that is this eclectic. And, but it wasn't that engineered. It was more like, oh, I really like that. I think I'm going to learn how to take a photograph. Oh, I want to write about that. I think I'll do a little Kickstarter to see if anyone would support me writing a book. Oh, Random House gave me a publishing deal. Like, it was just these random, seemingly things, but I actually think it was God's grace in many ways. But I think where I regret not having the more traditional path, like, I didn't go to counseling, and I wish I had, because you can even hear it in my language now, reflecting on it. I'm pretty healed in a lot of these categories, but there's still scars, you know, that are kind of icky. And I'll have moments where I'll think of an old boss and I'll feel sad or hurt or angry. And it bums me out, kind of ruins my day when that happens. And I wish I had maybe taken more time to go through a process. I have four kids and I lived in Orange County. I didn't have a lot of time for process, and is how it felt. So I just next? Kind of very, very quickly tried to figure out a way to make a buck and did that.
Yeah. I want to lean into what you're doing now. Because somehow yeah. I found myself in it and experiencing the fruit of all that it is. And so when I tell people what I'm doing, they say, what and why? And this thing that I'm doing is men and women of discomfort. And not only yes. am I doing it, I signed up for, I applied to be in it, and I'm paying for it. And so people say, like, you signed up for something called Men of Discomfort, Men and Women of Discomfort. I'd be the men's side of things. That would be the worst thing that anybody could ever sign up for, and why? What was yes. the genesis of this? And then give us a little bit of background on what is this thing that you're doing?
Yeah, probably the quickest way for anyone to understand what we're doing is it's a very simple proposition. You make one choice to participate. And in that single choice for 12 weeks, at least initially for the first 12 weeks, we make all your choices for you comprehensively. So let me be more concrete of what that means. We prescribe how much, I love that the thumb down just happened on my video, kind of the gesture thing, because <Yeah. laughs> even the algorithm knows this is a bad idea. So I get it. But the we prescribe when you can eat, what you can eat, what you can't eat. We prescribe how much water is required to drink every single day. We require how many hours you need to be in bed. We are very direct to say you're not allowed to have a phone in bed with you at any moment over the course of this whole window of time. We, every Monday, will ratchet additional habits on top of intermittent fasting. We'll add cold showers. We'll add anonymous good deeds, meditation, journaling, reading, cold water exposure, breath hold, and on and on and on. Basically, hunt for the particular discomfort that bugs you. So, Matt, you have a particular set of discomforts that really bug you, and there's probably other things in the practice that we prescribe that you would say, actually, I have no problem with that. That part's actually pretty cool. But there's something, we're pretty comprehensive. So when we remove booze and sugar and make you eat whole foods only and tell you the windows of time you can do it all in, it really interrupts people's lives in a pretty drastic way. And not only your life, but those around you. But it's that intervention in that first window of time that people may be motivated to do it. Like we were, me and my buddy Tim, who started it. It was mainly vanity. We were like, we just want to look better when we get out of the shower. We're tired of having dad bods. And we were experimenting with this notion of being uncomfortable intentionally, voluntarily. And then as Tim and I had been doing this for a while and a handful of people had joined us and we were having fun, just being knuckleheads, and we were getting in shape and all that stuff was great. But then Tim got really sick. So Tim got stomach cancer. And in that season of life, in his final year of life before he died and left Jessica and Holt and Henry, his two boys, he he discovered something, and he loved Jesus. He would say God's grace is what held him up. There was no ambiguity about that. And he would add, he was glad that his quote was, "I'm glad I did Men of Discomfort before I did chemo." That it put him in a position of actually having a skill, being able to navigate involuntary discomfort that he had practiced through voluntary discomfort way before. And I think that's at the heart of what we build into. We're unlikely people to have discovered this stuff. And I just happened to be the guy that caught the ball when Tim died and went, we need to organize this in such a way that more, if they're interested, could participate. Fully recognizing our tagline at Men and Women of Discomfort is, it's probably not for you. Like, there's a lot of good people who will never choose this. And we get it. It's not a moral thing. We don't think we're superior. We just have, it feels like we've discovered, like in the way Paul describes, I found the secret to life. It feels like we found the secret to life, in that I know how to navigate life when I have a lot, and I know how to navigate a life when I have nothing. And we've even, over time, as we've had several rounds of this with hundreds of people participate, we've learned, gosh, what is it about being a human being that we're up against, whether you're a faith-based person or not, that are really constant. So things like the drift of life, or we call the whirlwind of being a human, like circumstances that happen to you, whether you prefer it or not, involuntary discomforts, and how our reaction to those two things, entropy and these storms in our lives, often our default responses, give me comfort, give me relief, give me ease, give me support. And even your comment about like going to therapy after being let go, that would be I get why people would want to do that. And there's seasons where that is absolutely critical. But if you stay in support for too long, we all know we stagnate. We actually go in reverse. It has a diminishing return over time. And at some point, we need to get off the mat and stand up again. And how exactly do we do that? How do we develop this capacity to do hard things when we're constantly tempted to do the comfortable thing in the midst of the storms and in the midst of the drift? And our community is our response to that. This is how we've decided to organize our lives. And the result is, not only are people getting in stupid good shape and all that stuff, but they're flourishing. Like they're discovering, like they're doing things that their future self wishes they would do right now, and they're actually doing it. And I think the ingredients in our community really help perpetuate that.
I didn't realize in the beginning of all of this, my addiction to comfort, my need for comfort, to have the shower be really hot. And you found the one for me, and it surprised me, actually. It's not the, 16 hours of fasting. That's pretty easy for me. But it's the cold shower, and especially in Kentucky, where I spent a week in California, and the cold shower was way different than the one over here.
Yes.
And I just, like, I stood outside of the shower stall for a good 5 minutes trying to talk myself into it. And I'm 6 weeks in, and it's still hard. And to just be able to like actually calm myself down in the midst of all of that. But it is our addiction to comfort. And there's a motivational speaker out there, Brendan Burchard. And
yes,
he talks about this caged, comfortable, or charged. Where are you, right? And I think that a lot of people that are coming out of ministry, they're doing that because they feel caged. People who've been there for too long and just kind of floating, they're in that comfortable. But really, like, there is this movement for us, even in this season, of choosing voluntary discomfort. On the other side of that is this charged life. Is that what you've been seeing just over and over again?
Over and over again. And in shocking ways that we never could have predicted. Again, I don't want to minimize the reality of, like, comfort is killing us, right? Like, the stakes are pretty high. If you look at just physically, like hypertension, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, like it's amazing how these obvious scientific truths are the natural fruit of constant comfort. If you sit all day long if you consume processed food all day long, if you have no limits on your alcoholic intake, like you add that up one choice at a time, drip, 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 over a day, a week, a month, a year, a decade, you're going to die way sooner. Your visceral fat, the fat around your organs, will increase to a point where your organs are going to be compromised. It's going to be harder for you to exercise, harder for you to kind of maintain bone density. So like there's really practical, you know, charged life that just happens when you start actually taking care of your body. And I think there's this myth of like, yeah, my future self will take care of that. I'm going to kick the can down the road. Someone else will do that problem, deal with that. And I think this kind of forces the issue because most everyone I talk to has some sense of like, oh, I used to be an athlete, or, oh, I used to be disciplined in school, or I remember that guy. Or they might even think, because I used to be that person, I still am. But if you look at the results of their life currently, that's not true. That's just not true. Like Tim used to describe me as puffy Dana, because I had a little puff carrying around everywhere I went. And it's all forgivable. In fact, if anything, it's celebrated. It's like, oh, look at you, you know. And
more to love.
Yeah, right. More to love.
That used to be my nickname. But, yeah.
Up until now. Yeah. So there's that part of it that I just don't want to minimize. I think that there's real significant benefit, especially if you think of like time with your kids, your grandkids, being able to like, some of what motivated me early on was I read about this thing called the Centenarian Olympics, where people would train for if they were competing as a 100-year-old, if they have to, what would the things they'd be doing? And they would, Dr. Peter Attia talks a lot about this, the idea of like, well, you'd probably want to pick up your grandkids or your great grandkids. And let's say they're 65 pounds. Well, you can pick up a 65-pound kettlebell. Can you do a kind of a clean and squat with a 65-pound kettlebell? Well, you can do that with a kid then. And why can't you do that when you're 80 or 90 or 100? Well, it's because you didn't get ready for it. You didn't prepare for it. And this was so redeeming because I was heading towards 50 and I thought, oh, this is so cool because I can, you know, I was never an Olympian, even though that was my aspiration as a young athlete. And I thought, well, now I can compete for the Centenarian Olympics. I have 50 years to train for it. And kind of that framing was kind of just kind of helpful. Like this is a much longer game. The more I've gotten into it, the more I'm like, oh, I actually just like how I live. Like I'm that charged sense that Brandon's talking about and you're pointing to, is the kind of life that I don't know anyone who doesn't want that output. What people don't want is the process to get that output. That's what comes up over and over again.
The goal is not to create a bunch of centenarians, people who are living to 100 years old. There's actually this goal that's part of it. And you say that the goal is, the outcome is that we want to be people who are strong and awake for love's sake.
That's right.
What does that mean?
Well, let's go back to the church context for a minute. I don't know anyone who has had a negative experience working in a church. I know it's not just church, it could be nonprofit and other places, but
yeah.
I don't know anyone who's come out of that, a negative experience, who don't appeal to some political frustration, some hierarchical misuse of power, some power. Like there was a power issue. And they were kind of playing this game where they're like, if I can get into a position of power, then I'm going to be safe. Or something like that. I don't, this is kind of rough language, but that's the power game was not very interesting to me because there was too many situations where I didn't have it. But strength is interesting because strength actually, in contrast to power, is something that I can work on in the privacy of my own home when no one's looking. Mm. Strength is something that I have total agency over if I want to build it. And using our embodied self, like through movement, you know, functional movement and strength training and cardiovascular training, those kinds of efforts are smart to do because I actually get stronger so that even under misuses of power, I'm able to navigate those things. So strong seemed like a natural adjective to point to that I would want to develop in my life. But often before strong, we put it second because it rhymes, but the awake part is actually often more important. If we're asleep at the wheel, if we're sleepwalking through life, we don't even know that we've become weak. We're just like Anthony DeMello, the famous Catholic priest who had such remarkable kind of intuitions around Hindu culture that helped so many Christians evolve in their thinking. would often talk about people are, you know, born in their sleep. They grow up in their sleep. They get married in their sleep. They have babies in their sleep and they die in their sleep. They never wake up. We're always sleepwalking. Wow. And there's nothing like a cold shower to wake you up. And I think that this is the exercise that we're in. Whether it's a cold shower or whether it's having to check in on a video app that people don't want to do, or even just not putting creamer in your coffee or not being able to have a cocktail when I damn well please. It's amazing to me the level of entitlement that people have that gets revealed through this process of giving up their choice, their optionality. And that's what the exercise is we're perpetually inviting people to get curious, to wake up, and to choose the disciplines that make you strong. And this is the kicker. At some point along the way, they get really bored with their own strength and awareness. If you're the end of the game, it's not very interesting, especially when you realize we're all dying. So if that's so, what higher plane, what thing, and this is where Jesus followers have a remarkable advantage. We actually know what love's sake is. We actually have, we do can appeal to a transcendent thing that's bigger than us. It's going to outlive our vapor existence on this earth. And not just generationally, but in all of God's creation. And I think that if we're really appealing to that, we quickly get very uninterested with conversations around job security and bonuses and being wronged. Like, we just don't care about those things. None of us are going to care about those things. I'm not, all these concerns I have about being fired wrong or whatever, I'm not going to be thinking about that on my deathbed at all. It won't even occur to me. What's going to occur to me is, did I live in the midst of it? Was I awake? Was I doing the things that put me in a position of strength, not just for this life, but for the life to come? Was I doing it unto something bigger than myself that transcended the brokenness of our world? And that's what we've seen happen as an outcome consistently with people who take this on as a practice.
The role of community is interesting in this. And it was the thing that I probably grated against a little bit was just, there's people in my life, they'll say, hey, you want to go for a run? I'm like, well, number one, it's a run, so no. And number two, the worst possible thing I could do is run, and especially with somebody who wants to talk to me while I'm running, which is just the worst possible. But to do all of this in community, I was like, how are you going to do this in community when everybody's nationwide and in different places? Yeah. And so you're leveraging Marco Polo as an app, and we're checking in. But there's some incredible pieces. And I think one of the things that we realize in coming out of ministry is that we're so surrounded by community. People who are coming out of ministry find themselves immediately very, very isolated, unless they stick around in their church like you did for a bit. But you find yourself.
But you're right, and I felt very alone in that in a different kind of way. To be in, but not in.
No, that's totally true. I can see that.
Yeah,
but how does going through discomfort in the wake of or being surrounded by community, why was that an important piece for you in this process? Is it just accountability or is there something more?
No, it's not even accountability. I don't hold anyone accountable at Men and Women of Discomfort. We create a context where people can account for their own life. That's all we do. And we set the rules of the game up such that people are invited to do that. It's important that people understand that, because otherwise it becomes another power dynamic where I'm telling people what to do. I don't get any credit if people do it or don't do it. It's up to you, Matt. You're the one doing the work. And we're just creating a context where that's more likely to happen. And I do think community is critical to that end, but in a surprising way. I'm involved in another community that's very, I think a lot of folks can relate to this. And there's been really interesting articles written about this relative to the church too, contrasting the church with organizations like CrossFit. So I'm a CrossFit athlete. I've been part of CrossFit for the last maybe 2 or 3 years. And I've been CrossFit adjacent for a long time. But CrossFit's famous for a handful of things, one of which is if you run into somebody who does CrossFit, you know about it in the first 2 minutes because it's a cult. It's a total, like, in the best sense of that word, it's like a vegan or a or me, you know, being a brand new Christian. Like, I was so enthused with the thing that I couldn't imagine anything more interesting to talk about than that thing. But it begs the question, what is it about CrossFit that's so particularly interesting? And here's my thesis. All of my best friends are people I've suffered with. All of them. I don't know anyone who I can trust who I haven't suffered with. And CrossFit's the 1 hour of the day where I go to, we call them boxes, and I show up with the weirdest cross section. It's like, it's more weird than an AA meeting. Like, it's just this, like, it breaks through all social barriers and all things. And this group of 20 odd people get together and, you know, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, or 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. or whatever it is. And we do the workout of the day. We do what we're told. We submit to a practice. And it's almost always awful. And no one ever is upset at the end of the workout that they did it. Everyone's grateful. And I realized, like, and you had this weird kind of weird bonding that happens in the midst of that context. The bummer part of CrossFit is when you leave that hour, you go back to your life and you don't have any of that built in. So some of MWOD is kind of like taking that kind of an ethos and applying it to the whole of your life and leveraging things like asynchronous communication through apps like Marco Polo or Volley or whatever ones that you guys want to take advantage of. And I think it's a far more sticky, it's the closest thing to a conversation that we have, video-centric communication that's asynchronous. And to feel like, Matt, you and I are actually in close proximity. And this has been amplified post, you know, pandemic with, you know, Zoom culture and that sort of thing. But asynchronous is a little different than Zoom or Riverside, where we are right now. And I think those things have surprisingly converged into this sense of like disproportionate engagement. We're all doing our own practice somewhere. We are counting on our own to this little device, and it doesn't take, it gives. And that it doesn't just create a connection, it creates a conversation. And I think that common bond is at the core of the community element. And we don't just do asynchronous, we do synchronous calls, you know, 2 or 3 times over the course of 12 weeks. But I think it's just very difficult to go solo, to be some kind of rugged individual when it comes to these kinds of things. And I think people who've been in churches understand that probably more than ever. What I'm really sad about churches, because I think that with the stuff we're talking about has huge implications for the church. I don't know any churches actually that don't do this. That don't lean towards the therapeutic, you know, that old triumph of the therapeutic idea of like, when someone's hurt, send them to therapy. When someone's hurt, you know, give them a hug and don't let go. Like, they need to be comforted and give them a bonbon even. I don't think that's actually what we need all the time. I think support is critical so that we can challenge, because challenge is required in order to create compression. Compression is the vehicle to growth. So I think it's one of the reasons why God allows involuntary discomforts to happen to us in our lives, is because if we're not going to select the conditions for us to grow, God will help us, because he wants us to grow. So if I was going to summarize the benefit of the community piece, I would say 2 things. One, we're meant to be individuals who choose to be part of collectives and then to thrive. And then 2, I wish some of the most profound collectives, churches, would ask more of their participants in their discipleship. Because right now, there's no discipline in discipleship. In my experience, it's mostly optional. And I think it's one of the reasons why we don't have as many flourishing Christians in the first place.
That's good. You know, it makes me think of a couple things. Number one, if you don't want to do CrossFit at 5 a.m., you can find a weird cross section of people in Walmart at 2 a.m. So that's just another option. Just want to throw that out there to people.
Find your people.
Walmart bingo. But the other, I mean, the other pieces with that, I remember Francis Chan telling a story. He went to go visit like 23 South Korean pastors that were taken and lived in these internment camps in North Korea and would daily be brought out to the firing line thinking that that was the day that they were going to be executed. And after a year and a half of living like this in discomfort, were released, and they would have an annual get together, recounting and remembering that moment, those moments. And when Francis Chan was there, he was visiting this group while they had one of these meetings, and he said that the craziest thing was that one of the guys looked at him and said, "Don't. Sometimes I wish that we were back there in that place, that we're so close, not to just each other, but to God in the midst of that." And there's something about in the midst of, it's being in the lion's den, it's being in the fire, that there is a presence. And that's what I love about the wilderness. I haven't chosen the wilderness or that disorientation, but it is during those times that I know, even the wilderness in my own marriage, wilderness for that I've done it to myself, but that God was present with me in all of that. And so I found that the community aspect of all of this has been a surprising blessing, and it's actually replaced. I have a half-hour commute on the way to and from every single day, and it used to be filled with podcasts or catching up on the latest news. And now my days are, my commutes are filled with listening to people checking in, talking about their struggles. But the kicker, and this is the kicker, is that there's something called Friday Fess Up. And you have managed to create confession within a community of believers and non-believers alike. And I don't know if I've heard confession, even in the church, as authentic as I've heard it within men and women of discomfort.
That might be my most favorite thing that we do, is Friday Fess Up. Yeah, and that's too strong to say, but it's a little. All I have to say is it's a jewel that not people don't see right away, but it sneaks up on them. One of the things that is critical to understand about Men and Women of Discomfort, in contrast with other outfits out there, like there's a well-intentioned group out there, a guy named Andy Frisella runs a thing called 75 Hard, and 75 Hard is very famous. Millions of people do it all over the world, and 75 days of very rigorous. You don't make many choices. They make a lot of choices for you. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine yesterday who he was like, "I can't listen to Andy anymore." And I'm like, "Oh, why? What is it about him?" And he says, he seems angry all the time. And the expectation is that everyone's a beginner all the time and he knows and everyone else doesn't. And I was like, "Oh, I mean, I can see why he's appealing to his lead gen and, you know, and all the different things he's doing." But what was more interesting to me was for the people who've done it, I've done it, and the people who've done it, if you ask anybody who does 75 Hard, I say, "What happened on day 76? And the answer is always the same, like nothing, like a donut is what happened on day 76. Right. Like, finally, I'm done. And there's a sense in which I can see why people would maybe think about that with Men and Women of Discomfort too. But that's actually not how it's experienced for people. What's far more common is a sustainable view. And one of the reasons we make it sustainable is we don't expect perfection. Although, especially Christians who are participating, there's a lot of perfectionists who come in who are really trying to be good and dot all their I's and cross all their T's and check all their boxes. And we keep saying to them, and they get it usually around week eight or nine, like, we actually could give a rip about perfection, because I already know if I were to survey the actual practice you're doing, you're missing the mark all over the place. What I'm interested in isn't perfection. What I'm interested in is wholeheartedness, that you're all in as best you can pull off right now. And we just know that you ratchet that over time at any intensity. If you just consistently show up, you will become the thing that you're training to become. And that's the exercise. And is that not true in discipleship? Like, perfect disciple, give me a break. But wholehearted disciple? Yeah, 100%. So the idea of Fess Up Friday was basically to get people who were checking the boxes but weren't really into it to stop lying and to be real about it. So the way we do Fess Ups is we say, "Hey, where did you miss the mark on your prescribed commitment? What did you learn? What are you going to do different?" Which sure sounds a lot like, "Forgive me, Father, I've sinned." And you're in a little, you know, confessional box, and you're a little freed up. You're a little sensitive, like, "I get to go again. Tomorrow's day one. And I don't know what authorities, power people in the church would say about our little confessional booth, but I sure like it.
Yeah. Well, I don't see you forgiving people, so that's good. And it's not an act against you. It really is a commitment that we miss toward ourselves. And so,
that's right.
it is so refreshing to hear confession. It shocked me the first week. I was like, I had no intention whatsoever to even ever confess. I was like, what is this thing? And then to hear that was really good. Just knowing the people that we're talking to and listening to this podcast, that they're already or they're considering a change, a transition season where they're finding themselves in the land of discomfort, or biblically, it's the valley of Achor. It's the valley of trouble. And we don't like being there. And I think for the Israelites, they would either say, just get me back to Egypt so I could eat leeks, which who likes leeks? I think they're horrible. Or just get me to the promised land. But we are not content with where we're at here in the land of discomfort. And so we would rather go back to Egypt. And I remember Paul Young, mutual friend, he said, like, if I had a book, the first line of my book would be, you may call it a prison, but I call it home. And isn't it funny that how willing we are to go back to this sedentary life where you're not strong and you're not awake and you're not living wholeheartedly. Yeah. It's so interesting that we would rather go back there than to be in this discomfort where God is very much relationship based in all of that and moving us towards something that's greater, moving us towards something that's better. So it's been such a great, beautiful picture for me. There's all kinds of layers. I want you to tell me about the buffalo. Tell me the story about the buffalo.
Can we go back one half step? Because I do want to talk about the buffalo, but I want to, this Valley of Trouble is very interesting to me. And you and I have a common experience with trouble, with an ad about trouble. And there's an ad that you and I have both been exposed to through the Store Brand Workshop put up by Gerber. So the Gerber, the knife maker, and the ad's called, I think it opens up, I don't know what it's called, but it's called Unstoppable. And it opens up with, "Hello, Trouble." And it has this cool, like, Western voice, Sam Shepard, somebody who it is, I don't know who it is who's saying it, but he's like, and it goes through a series of moments where it's describing the Valley of Trouble that you're describing. And, like, visually, and it's chaos, it's things going bad. It's your legs tied up in a rope under a motor in the water. It's going up a mountain. It's cold and broken and ice and glass. And then there's a turn in the story of the ad. And it's basically saying, like, I know who you are, Trouble, but do you know who I am? And then the last third of the ad is like, I'm coming after you. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for trouble. And at the end of it, everyone wants to buy a Gerber knife. And like, well, why do I want to buy a Gerber knife? And it's because they've brilliantly associated this notion of courage and bravery and being the kind of person who walks towards the hard thing as opposed to runs from it. And they associate it with this tool called a knife. And I think if I have this knife, I'll be a little bit more brave, right? So very clever marketing. More importantly, it's actually how the world actually works. So anyone who's in the Valley of Trouble, it's so tempting to go, I just want this trouble to go away. Precisely at the moment where they're on the edge of, if they could lean into the trouble, if they could embrace the discomfort, if they could walk towards the valley as opposed to run back to the mundane, the stagnancy that they were experiencing before, the very place that they would do anything to leave, they will find the gold. They will just find it. That is where God lives. That is where God comes from. And it is terrifying. Like, I get why people don't do it. I get why I don't want to get in the cold shower every day. But it is a spiritual practice, and one that people have been doing for a long time. Like Eugene Peterson, you know, everyone, he's a patron saint for almost everyone who's listening to your podcast, I'm sure. And he's, you know, he had a lake on his property that he would get up every morning and baptize himself in the cold water of Montana to remind himself which, like, that's where Jesus was. It was in the death, burial, and resurrection. It was like, I'm alive. It's the charge that you're describing. Mm. And yet we think, no, he's in the cozy. Even this notion of like, I just need more balance in my life. I know there's people who've just been fired from a church and like, I just need more balance. And whatever, man, like what they're really saying is they want relief. They want the easy path. And they can have it. It's available. The problem is it's going to yield what easy paths yield. And that is not what they really want. That's not what they're looking for. So you asked about the buffalo. And the buffalo is our logo. And we're not the only outfit who've learned this about the buffalo. But it turns out the buffalo is famous in the animal kingdom for being one of, if not the only animal, that when the storm hits, it runs toward the storm as opposed to run away from the storm. And that's very different than cows and bulls. And you have an amazing story about the cow thing that if you haven't shared it on the podcast, you should in a second. But it could be that the bulls are the buffaloes are just dumb. Like they just don't know any better. And that's a reasonable hypothesis and explanation. And we're just dumbos. Okay. So that's one option. Sure. Second option is, in terms of theories as to why buffaloes do this, why are they the only animal that runs toward the storm? It's because it's actually the productive way to get through a storm. If you want to get through a storm quickly, if you run away from it, guess what's going to chase you? The storm. It's following you. And you're actually making the miserable nature of the storm go longer than it needs to go. That's the second theory. The third, and they know better, so they go through the storm passes quicker. Third is, that's actually where all the good stuff is. Because when the storm hits the grass and the dirt and the, it throws everything up and toils everything and turns everything, well, guess what's in this path? Well, all the vegetation that the buffalo need, all the good stuff. They get it first. And they're smart enough to like be the early worm that gets the bird, or be the early bird to get the worm, whatever it is. And I love all those answers. I think I do get the good stuff by living like this. I do think that storms, like when I have a hard start to my day through voluntary discomfort, and then I go into my job in my day and someone yells at me or whatever, I'm not even, this is so little compared to what I went through this morning. You're nothing, bless your heart. Like that used to take me out and now it's nothing. And we might just still be knuckleheads doing dumb things, and we're probably not for you. And if that's the case, great. But if you're sitting at home going like, oh man, there's just too much here and I kind of want to barf, but I think I want to look up the website, then you're tracking it right. If you're thinking about it like, oh, this would be a cool challenge, you're totally missing what we're doing entirely. And I would really discourage you from checking out what we're doing. But if you want to barf, that's a sign that this might just be for you to try this on for size.
I told the story of the buffalo. It's inspired me. And I was at a keynote in Florida and told that story. And there's a guy who comes up to me afterwards and he says, I grew up in the Midwest and my family, we've done cattle our whole life. And we had one day, it was particularly, I'll never forget it. Storm came in and we had 75 cows try to get away from the storm. And as they're running away from the storm, once the storm passed, they had 75 cows that ran into the electric fence and they all killed themselves on there. Mm. And it created this immediate problem that now they have to actually, if they're going to preserve the meat, they have to butcher 75 cows, which is also not a very easy process. But that is a good picture of our society, of those of us who are running away from this discomfort. What does it look like for us to actually get through the storm? And what I love probably most about all of it is that you become the kind of person that's not afraid of the storm.
That's right.
Right? So you get to run in it. And we're talking to people every day of the week who have found themselves in a storm. Either they found themselves going into it or the storm has hit them, what you would call the whirlwind. And I think we lack the tools as a people most of the time to be able to sufficiently deal with it. It derails us. We don't function after all of that. I love the buffalo.
Yeah, I love that old Winston Churchill line of, if you're going through hell, keep going. And that's good advice. because most of the time it's not just I'm choosing voluntary discomfort in a vacuum. It's usually I'm choosing voluntary discomfort in the midst of, like, I'll speak of my own situation, my real life. Like, my mom has Alzheimer's, and she's in significant mental decline and is suffering remarkably. And she lives in a different country than I live in. And my brother has the burden of taking care of her and the privilege. And there's a sense of, like, distance and guilt and frustration and difficulty. And even to go and be with them and contribute is actually another kind of discomfort. And that's just one lane of my life. I also have four kids. My youngest just turned 18. One's in Spain. I have one in Santa Barbara. I have one in Sacramento. None of them are completely off my payroll yet. There's this notion of provision. We're in the middle of selling a house, moving from Northern California to Southern California after just being here for 3 years. I live in community with my brother and sister-in-law right now. Like, and none of us have cancer. None of us, but we could tomorrow. None of us have gotten in a significant car wreck, although that's how my dad died. Like, we're always in storms. There's always some sense of, like, this fantasy of I'm going to get to someday where these aren't true. When in reality, we know this is a perpetual reality. It's all involuntary discomforts are always going to be happening. And that's why I think so many people are daunted by the idea of, like, life is already so hard. Why would I choose hard again? Mm-hmm. And so this is where I do have empathy for people, but I also recognize staying in the storm is not, and sitting still is not going to actually make the storm go away. What if you were to improve your capacity to live in that storm, to navigate that storm, to guide others in that storm, to be the resource that others could lean into when they don't have the resource themselves? And I think there's some really interesting practitioners right around this moment in various disciplines and traditions that are noticing and talking about this a lot right now. You hear Jordan Peterson talking about this quite a bit. You hear Ryan Holiday, famous Stoic, probably my favorite atheist out there, but he reads a lot of C.S. Lewis, so maybe he's coming around, who knows. But there's so many thoughtful people out there, not just the crazy David Gogginses of the world, who I also deeply appreciate, but there is a group of practitioners who've discovered the secret, and I would just love to see, especially in the faith community, in people who follow Jesus, to recognize that Jesus was a man of discomfort. We say we pattern our life after him. To suggest that he wasn't voluntarily choosing discomfort would be ridiculous. And what position did that put him in his capacity to serve others through strength and awareness and love?
Yeah. The fact that he empties himself or for the joy set before him, endures the cross. Like, yeah, there's some, yeah, that's brilliant. Well, I want to wrap it up. I don't want to wrap it up, but I'm going to wrap it up. For the person that is in this situation, that they found themselves in the valley of involuntary discomfort, they were placed there, life has put them there. One of the things that we talk about a lot is, it's not I have to do this, I get to do this. Is there a good spin on I get to do this, I get to go through this season, and to not waste even this season of discomfort?
Yeah, one of the proverbs that has been instrumental in my own life, it's very quick. It's just this. So two men are pushing rocks up a hill. One guy's pushing rocks. The other guy's building a cathedral. And the reason I like this framing is you're looking at the pitch of the hill is the same. The weight of the rock is the same. The heat of the day is the same. The strength of the individuals that are lifting them are the same. Yet one person is relating with the rocks differently than the other. Their way of being is distinct because of the vision that is set before them. And as a result, it feels like both, it would be wrong to say one rock is lighter or heavier than the other, but because I actually think they would feel the same, but the purpose of the suffering, the intention behind it, the unto what, even the ability to have a perspective on the suffering is so critical to not just getting through it, but to not wasting it, to getting as much out of it as you possibly can. It's an amazing training tool. And I think that's much of what we talk about. So when we say have to versus get to, if everything in life is a chore, if everything is a valley of trouble, and you don't actively think, well, if I could relate with this in a new way, might this exact same thing actually help to transform me into what I want to become, as opposed to I'm a victim to it? That's what I would invite people to consider. Because I think a lot of the circumstances that people are in right now, we can't fix the circumstance. But as we've known for a lot of years, in a lot of different iterations of wisdom, we can control our response to it. And I would argue that that is true of the entire human condition. So that's what I would encourage. Whether or not they check out MWOT is really beside the point. It's more, are they going to decide to relate with the thing that they're in the midst of in a way that gives them hope, that gives them faith, that gives them a chance to believe that God's active in the thing that they're in the midst of? And in my experience, they absolutely will. And I think it's one of the tricks of the enemy to just keep people in perpetual despair. That old Kierkegaard line, man finds the level of despair he can tolerate and calls it happiness. I think there's a lot of people who are listening today who are in despair, and they weren't willing to know about it until now. And as they're aware of it, the question becomes, what do they want to do with it?
It's gold. It's fantastic. Dane, if somebody's crazy enough to say, I want to be in, and I want to, this is for me, and they feel like they need to throw up. Mm-hmm. What is that next step for them? How do they get in touch?
Yeah, even if they don't do it, I think going to either menofdiscomfort.com or womenofdiscomfort.com, it's the same website, it's mwod.io, but all these things forward. But I think even if they don't do it, I think filling out the application, just asking, we ask you some basic questions, mm-hmm. That will be kind of prompting, help you think through, is this the right season for you? And I think that could be really resourceful for folks. Because I'm on this Marco Polo thing a lot, if anyone wants to chat about it directly with me, I actually have a thing called askdane.com, and people can go to askdane.com and just leave a little video, we'll walkie-talkie back and forth, and no one will see it but me. So it's just a private conversation, but sometimes that can be helpful as well.
Dane, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for jumping on.
You too, man.
And you are experiencing, there is life after ministry. And not only that, it sounds like there's ministry after ministry as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate all that you're doing and the way that you lead.
Thanks, brother. Well, thanks for listening to this episode of the Life After Ministry podcast. One of the things that Dane and I talked about was this idea of the Valley of Achor. It's the Valley of Trouble. You actually find it, you can look it up in Hosea chapter 2, verses 14 and 15. And you know the backstory of Hosea, that Hosea has this wife, Gomer, that has run amok and she's run off. And really, this is a parallel of the story of God as the loving husband in Israel, the bride has run off and run amok. But even in the midst of that, God is still calling his people back. And it says in Hosea 2, 14 and 15, it says this, "Therefore, behold, I will lure her, and I will bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her." That even, I just want you to hear that, in the midst of the wilderness, that God has brought us in there, and in the wilderness, God will speak tenderly. And it says in verse 15, "And there I will give her her vineyards." I don't know if you've ever been in a wilderness or not, but there's not a lot of vineyards that are growing out there. But God says, "There I'll give her her vineyards, and I will make the Valley of Achor a door of hope." This word Achor in the Hebrew, it means the Valley of Trouble. And it is this trouble, if you go back to Judges chapter 7, without getting into a whole Bible study, but Judges 7 was this place of shame. It was the place of Achan's sin, and where his entire family and his livestock were taken into this valley and killed, because the result of his sin really meant for the entire community a tremendous loss in battle. But God says, "I'm going to take your valley of trouble, whether you put yourself there or whether the circumstances of life put you there." God says, "In the wilderness, I'll give you vineyards. In the wilderness, I'll take that valley of trouble and I will make it a door of hope." And I just pray that as you listen to this episode, that you may find yourself, if you are in that place of trouble, that God would meet you. This is what we're all about with Pastoral Transitions. Pastoral Transitions is the ministry that is fueling this podcast, Life After Ministry. And our heart is to help people who are coming out of full-time or even part-time vocational ministry and trying to figure out what's next, trying to make sense of the wilderness, trying to make sense of the current discomfort that they find themselves in. And then we walk with them through that journey so that they might get to the promised land. If you are in that spot, if you are a leader in a church and you see restructuring, or you know that there's somebody that you need to let go of, our hope is that we get to partner with you in that journey and to be able to walk with you no matter what side of the equation you might find yourself in. And we also have a growing number of pastors that are reaching out to us, and they were let go months ago, weeks ago, days ago, and have no resources whatsoever. And if you are in a position, or your church is in a position to be able to support them, we do have a nonprofit arm of what we're doing. And you can go to our website, pastoraltransitions.com, and there's a donate button, and you can make a donation. And you can specify it on behalf of a certain pastor, or if it's just the general fund, we'll help everybody who comes, or anybody who comes to us that we want to be able to offer that. So thank you for listening. We pray that this is helpful for you. And wherever you're going, whatever valley you find yourself in walking through right now, we pray that you will seek the Lord, you will find the Lord, even in these valleys of trouble. Shalom.